will go through the bill with the department, make sure that we understand whatever it is that is in this bill, so that as we go forward, we all have a backdrop of understanding exactly what we're dealing with here. So we are going to start today, and I'm hoping we will get through Articles 1 and 2 anyway today, and we will just keep plowing through this. If it takes all week, it takes all week, but I don't want it to take more than all week. I suppose we could meet Thursday night. What do you think of that? You like that, Scott? So could I ask, please, for Mr. Melcher and the commissioner to come to the table? And this is House File 1323, but it is an unofficial reading through. We aren't taking public comment. We aren't taking amendments or anything like that today. This is to understand exactly what we have in this bill.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Dr. Melcher and I are going to kind of go back and forth between the policy and the financial implications of the bill. We do have some, certainly new things, and we want to make sure to explain them. And so as we get into the finance impact, we'll kind of break that up between the two of us. we are also working off of the House Research Summary. We want to thank Mr. Strom and Mr. Kroep and Ms. Larson for working on this. It's always appreciative to have their work.
Madam Chair and members.
Mr. Melcher.
Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. I'd like to take Article 1, Section 1 on page 2 of the bill. This is a definition of kindergarten, and the language defines kindergarten as a program for pupils who start the school year at the age of 5 years, and it prepares students for first grade, and also defines a program that prepares students for kindergarten as a pre-kindergarten program. This is consistent with the department's current interpretation. It was language that we had in our bill last year that was aimed at trying to clarify the issue that we had with the pre-kindergarten programs across the state.
Members, I would suggest that as we go, if you have questions, that you indicate that. Otherwise, we'll end up way beyond a section before we get to the questions. So please ask them as we go. We'll try to be alert to your hand in the air.
And Madam Chair, the next section is in regard to an educational improvement plan, and we basically are adding charter schools to that section of law. The next area that we're going to move into is the governor's QCOM proposal. And the existing...
Excuse me, we do have a quick question.
Yes.
Representative Heidgerker.
Sorry, just a question on the kindergarten. You said there was no changes. Why is it underlined then?
Mr. Cameron, Representative, Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Melcher.
Representative Heidgerker. Yeah. This is new language, which is clarifying the definition of kindergarten consistent with the department's current interpretation.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
The next section, Section 3, we begin to look at the governor's QCOM proposal, quality compensation for teachers. And what the governor has done is amended the existing pilot program that we have in place.
One more question, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, and if we could refer to page and line number so we can follow a little easier in the bill. It's a lengthy bill.
Mm-hmm.
And when you refer to a section number, then I'm flipping around trying to find it.
Okay.
That would be very helpful. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's helpful to all of us, Representative. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Newman, on page 3, section 3, line 23, begins the governor's language regarding his QCOM proposal or quality compensation. What the governor and the departments have recommended doing is amending the current pilot program that we have for alternative compensation to enhance the requirements and the quality of the program. And as we go through it, You can see that charter schools are, of course, added to the eligibility for this particular program. On page 4, you'll start to look at some of the things that you must do if you want to qualify. And one of those is to provide a multiple career path for our teachers, such as, and this is not something that you don't have to do this, but the examples would be such as a master or mentor teacher. In addition to that, you would also have to, in clause 1, I skipped over that, you have to describe how teachers can achieve career advancement. And then you have the multiple career paths. Clause 3 talks about a professional pay system that replaces the lockstep steps and lane system and replaces it with a system that allows districts and charter schools to compensate teachers for satisfactory service and completion of annual performance goals. And those can include, performance compensation for teachers based at a minimum on student achievement gains and school achievement gains based on locally selected standards or under Section 120B35 or both. And then also there are results of individual teacher evaluation based on classroom observation by a locally selected evaluation team. So you have those four components. You have evaluation, you have professional pay, you have professional development standards, and you also have a career ladder. The staff development must utilize best practice research as you develop that component of your QComp proposal. Staff development should be integrated and collaborative. It should provide ongoing site-based and teacher-led professional growth activities that are aligned with student needs and also focus on identified student needs, which may include reading strategies, methods to align curriculum with learning strategies, intervention with students not meeting proficiency level, and use of state and local assessment data. Then you must implement a teacher performance evaluation that is a comprehensive system based on scientifically based educational research.
Commissioner Segrin, yes. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Segrin, I'm looking at page 4, lines 10 and through 14, and it says, am I understanding this right, these are options. If we pass this proposal, in order to use the alternative teacher compensation, then districts would have to get rid of the lockstep steps and lanes. There's no option, because I'm thinking, Madam Chair and Commissioner, right now, for instance, Minneapolis is using this option, but they have kind of a parallel track, the way I understand it.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Segrin.
Madam Chair, the idea, and I'll try to explain it, would be, and actually some of this language, we've actually worked with Education Minnesota, they've actually suggested some language changes to the bill, and one of the things that in this particular area was some language that they suggested that we use. And I'm sure that they can come up and reconfirm that. But the idea would be to replace the process where you would move 1 year because of one more year's teaching experience or, have this automatic adjustment for education. It doesn't mean that you wouldn't maybe recognize some of that, but it wouldn't be an automatic kind of a situation. Intention would be still that you would certainly have salary ranges and the option of moving through those salary ranges, but it wouldn't be kind of this grid type of process that we have now. Teachers would be compensated on satisfactory service and completion of annual performance goals. So service is still a component of it, but it's constructed just a little bit differently.
Oh. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I understand, and I think, having different alternatives is something that's been widely supported and that we should be looking at. But I'm just trying to get at, is this saying that you couldn't participate in any of those options at all if you weren't getting rid of the steps and lanes?
Madam Chair,
Commissioner Segrin.
The intent would be to replace your lockstep system with a different kind of of salary system. It does not mean that you wouldn't have salary ranges or other advancement opportunities. It's just that you wouldn't have, you know, this necessarily automatic grid that you would be moving through.
So, Representative, Madam Chair, Mr. I take that's a yes. And then, so that...
A yes.
There would be a yes that you would have to get rid of the steps and lanes in order to use this compensation. The reason I'm trying to pin this down is because I think we are generally agreed that we do want to encourage different types of remuneration for teachers. And when we went down to CECA, they also, as I understood it, maintained, though, for now, their steps and lanes. So I'm thinking that if we have a cold turkey, you can't use this at all unless you get rid of it, that we'll have a lot fewer takers if we have to get this negotiated and get it started. And when we're on, I think, a trajectory of having a lot of reform in this area, I think to be this rigid about it might damage things, if I'm understanding that this is that rigid. That's what I'm trying to get straight.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner, I think I understood something a little different, that you could still recognize experience and you could still recognize the amount of education, but it wouldn't be the way it is now where, okay, automatically because you had one more year experience, you get a certain pay scale. It would be, there would be other elements upon which pay would be based. Does that make sense? Is that what you're saying, or am I wrong?
You're understanding it the way I would interpret it. The clause 3, the old language, Representative Grayling, said that they must use a professional pay system that replaces the step and lane salary schedule and is not based on years of service. So in the old model that we had, the old pilot, you had to get rid of years of service. We're actually kind of saying that we want to give districts the option of recognizing satisfactory service. So really what Representative Sikora was saying is actually a little bit better probably than the old way we were, you know, causing districts to participate. You can still recognize satisfactory service, but it's not necessarily an automatic that if you've taught another year that, you know, that is interpreted as satisfactory service. It's going to be based on individual professional goals, district and site goals, etc., that are established between the teachers and management as they're working through this. So I think it does give more flexibility and we would have creativity in how we're doing things. But I think that you're right, is right now maintaining their system and adding on to it. But this would require that you would look at a different pay structure, as did the old pilot program. It really was a different system, too.
Seeing no other questions, Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, again, is this site-based or is this based on a pupil count, district count, or whatever? I see when you read on page 5, it talks about the site's educational improvement plan, and earlier it talks about page 4 continuously with district plan. Say, for example, if I got 3 sites in a district, could I implement one site and use that one site, just the teachers that are teaching at that site, and implement that plan there?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
The bill does specify that either one site in a district or the whole district could participate.
Okay. At the same time, for example, like Waseca, they have, the school district has a charter school there, the elementary. So they could use that in the charter school system if they wished.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Segrin.
Charter schools would be eligible for this process too.
Okay. Even though it is operated by a district, school district.
Manager.
Commissioner.
Okay.
Regardless of who the sponsor is, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Then we have on page 5, subdivision 5, there would be a reporting process on the implementation and effectiveness of the program, and that copy of the report must be sent to the Commissioner of Education. And then we get into some of the revenue amounts, and Dr. Melcher, do you want to...
Yes, Madam Chair and members, on Section 4, beginning on the bottom of page 5 of the bill, but moving into page 6 of the bill, page 6, line 11, is changing the amount of revenue under the alternative compensation program from the current $150 up to $225 as the maximum. The language on the bottom of page 5 is also eliminating one provision of the current program which would allow a district to participate if at least 25% of the teachers in the district chose to participate. So under this plan, it would either be an entire site or an entire district, but the option of having a percentage of the teachers in every site would not be one of the options.
Representative Heidker.
Yes, before we go on, I have context. I'm looking at throughout the bill itself, you changed one word in particular. I'm wondering why. Every place aid was mentioned, you crossed it out and you added revenue. Why the change in wordage?
Madam Chair.
Dr. Melcher.
And Representative Heidgarten. The governor's recommendation is that beginning in the 2006-2007 school year, that the alternative compensation program be funded with a combination of state aid and property tax levies. And later on in the bill, there will be a calculation where $155 per pupil will be state aid and $70 per pupil will be property tax levies. And those,
okay,
those are later in Article 1.
Okay. Representative Dorn.
Thank you. Just on this same subject in thinking about this, do you think a school or a site on the alternative compensation system, do you think it would be theoretically possible that every teacher at that site or in that district could demonstrate that they were providing satisfactory service and would be meeting performance goals? I mean, is it possible that the result would maybe look like it were lockstep, but it really wasn't because it was a demonstrated service and a performance measurement that provided the decision to increase compensation?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Siegman.
I don't know. I think it would depend on what kind of a proposal the district came forward with, whether you could sufficiently demonstrate that the way you were measuring teachers or evaluating them was a legitimate evaluation. The intent would be that you would have personal goals set, not only professional goals for yourself, but also site goals, district goals. And the example I often use is, you know, if in your site, you as a group of teachers, as a team of teachers, have decided that perhaps your reading curriculum was going to be changed and you also wanted some additional professional training and growth in that area, or you were strategizing and set a particular reading achievement goal for your whole site because, you know, your students weren't doing as well and you wanted to work as a team, and that you set that goal. So you might have a professional, personal goal that maybe you needed some additional training and reading strategies, and then your site goal might be that also we want to get all of our students up to a certain proficiency level. And so then with those particular things, then you would be evaluated on whether, you know, you had actually improved your reading strategies, and then there would maybe be a site, you know, objective, and, you know, if the site, you know, met its goal there, then, you know, everybody had satisfactory service, that you personally met your goals and, you know, would have, whatever the salary increment would be. And then in addition to that, if there was some bonus money set aside for your whole site or people individually for other kinds of exemplary service or responsibilities, then that would be something that was negotiated. I think there's unlimited ways that you could look at this. I think the thing that I'm really excited about is the fact that you have, you know, the real potential of doing some very meaningful professional development that is needs-based in your site and in for your profession itself. And then you'll be able to also have that evaluation process for yourself individually and for your building. But I think it's going to result in some exciting student achievement and exciting professional growth for teachers.
And Madam Chair and Commissioner, the question somewhat came from our visit to Wauseka, where when I observed the first grade teachers working together and planning and going through what they had done in their next strategies, it really struck me that these were people that were totally devoted, working long hours, every ounce of energy, because they were teachers, because they wanted to improve what the kids were doing. I would have been hard pressed, I didn't obviously make the personal evaluations, but I would have been hard pressed to think that they weren't all improving what was happening with kids and working to improve themselves along with the people they were collaborating with. And so I was thinking, it would seem to me that it would be possible, even though it wasn't automatic, but that the end result would be that they would all have met personal and group performance goals
in
that system.
Madam Chair and Representative Gordon, and I think the difference between this proposal and the existing situation is that now for the first time you really are looking at a more personal and professional evaluation system that really is connecting what is happening in the classroom with you as a teacher or you mm-hmm. as a site. Whereas before, you may not. You may have a teacher who has not changed their lesson plans in 20 years and is just doing the same thing. Versus now, you know, everyone has mm-hmm. to really think about personally what's happening in their own professional life, but also with their site. So you really do now have a connection that is much more meaningful and professional, that you can tell, I think, demonstrate to the public that indeed, these are very high caliber teachers that are demonstrating true professionalism. So, not that they aren't now, but I think it really does make it a really exciting opportunity for people.
Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, you convinced me that on page 4, you know, that wasn't the biggest change. I think it was the editorial word lockstep that got me hung up there. So now if you could convince me on page 6 that this is a good idea, going from the option of having just, 25% or more of the teachers participate in this to all of them. I think this is a significant change. And I'm wondering, of the school districts that are currently doing this, how many of them have all the teachers doing it versus how many elected to have a portion of the teachers? Because I believe this is the section that might apply to Waseca.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Seguin.
Madam Chair, currently in our pilot programs, all of the school districts have all of their teachers participating except for Minneapolis, and I think they have about 40% of their teachers participating. And that would be the only exception. Everyone else has kind of gone into it completely.
I think, did you mean within a site, the percent of teachers at each site, or did you mean in a district?
Madam Chair, I think I meant district, because on page 6, line 13, it says a district. So Minneapolis is not, and then how many districts are using all their teachers?
Madam Chair, all the rest of the people that are participating have all of their teachers involved.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gladden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, what is the number, though?
Four.
Four. Four. So four do and one doesn't.
Right.
Commissioner, you may proceed.
Before we move on to Section 5, there is in Clause C, there is some direction for charter schools for their teachers to participate. There has to be a 70% of their teachers have to vote to participate in the QCOMP program. And then there also has to be a resolution by the charter school board. So there has to be both of those two groups assenting to this before they can move into the program.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Melcher.
The next section, Section 5 on page 7, line 7 and 8 of the bill is deleting a requirement that districts must apply by June 1st of the first year of the biennium to qualify for aid for the first year of the biennium, and replaces that with new language on lines 11 and 12 that requires that the district must have implemented the program for the full school year to qualify for that particular school year. The bill also on lines 23 through 29 is deleting language that requires the commissioner to do a round of initial approvals by January 15th and then a secondary round by February 15th.
May I just ask one question, Commissioner? How much prep time does it generally take a district to gear up or a school site to gear up to do this program? So how much advance, how much lead time are we talking about?
Well, Madam Chair, that might be something more appropriate to ask Dr. Melcher. I know he participated along with a number of other people in the first pilot program, and we're anticipating that I think when initially it started, it was probably, a good year or so before districts were really ready, but that was when it was a brand new concept. I think since that time there's been a lot more movement towards all of these different kinds of components that are in the QComp program or proposal. We deliberately just put $10 million in the first year of our proposal, anticipating that it would districts would need information and would need time to negotiate, because they will be starting to negotiate their salary settlements. And then we put in more money, $50 million, in the second year, anticipating that that there would be more available. We do have indications that there's probably two or three districts at least that have actually been in a process, been asking me, I know, for two or three years when we could, you know, grow this program, the old pilot program, that they have really been working on this concept. And so there, two or three at least are ready to go, and I think we would anticipate that we'd have a few the first year, but we would anticipate there would be more the second year. And our department also is, we've been getting a lot of inquiries about it, and we are certainly, you know, sending out as much information as we can about the concept and working with districts to help them understand it. And we will continue to do that for anyone that's interested.
Well, Commissioner, I have another question here from Representative Heidgerken, and I will also mention that I've had a number of districts talk to me about this idea, and they are afraid that the $50 million won't be sufficient, that there are so many people interested in this that you will have more than you can handle coming to the table. And have you considered that potential wonderful problem?
Well, that would be a wonderful, exciting problem. I think, decided on a number that we thought was realistic. We wanted to, give a lot of districts an opportunity to study the issue. So I think we tried to land on a figure that was realistic. If we're pleasantly surprised, you know, certainly we will look at coming back and increasing the money, the level of money for it.
Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You had referred earlier in your testimony that there's a couple school districts that have indicated to you ready interest, and I assume them to be charter schools, or?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Seigman.
No.
Okay. The other thing is I see some advantages. For example, Waseca, that's implemented a program, has got that in play. They may, of course, be one of the first school districts that probably would be looking at this. When you take the applications, how are you going to judge these applications?
Madam Chair and Representative Heidgerken, that is later on in the bill. If you could wait.
Okay.
Until we get there, we'll kind of talk about the application process and how it would work.
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, moving to Section 6 of the bill on page 8, this section of the bill, especially lines 16 through 19, are converting the post-secondary enrollment payments that are made to the colleges from a percentage of the general education formula to a fixed dollar amount per student. So these are delinking the PSEO payments from the general education formula and providing a 2% increase per year. So the $109 that you see on page 8, line 18, is a 2% increase over the current rate per credit hour for quarter credits, and then the $111 would be an additional 2% for the second year of the biennium. And then down on lines 23 and 24, we have a comparable set of calculation for semester credits. The $163 would be a 2% increase over the current rate, and the $166 is an additional 2% for the second year of the biennium. Moving to Section 7 of the bill, on page 9, lines 7 through 11, this section is changing the limited English proficiency program formula from using an adjusted marginal cost pupil unit calculation, which takes into account the prior year's count and the current year's count, and instead moving to a current year count. And then in order to make the total dollars that go out under LEP funding revenue neutral, it's increasing the formula rate from $700 to $704 per LEP student. And that takes effect in the second year of the biennium, along with the other changes that would be eliminating the adjusted marginal cost and pupil counts.
Representative Grant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Melcher, how will this play out with individual districts if they don't get to average out the 2 years, even though it might come out statewide? Wouldn't it kind of make some districts lurch a little bit?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Greiling, there are some relatively modest gainers and losers in that. I believe that the computer runs that we shared with you earlier when we were doing the overview did identify those dollar amounts, and I think in most cases it was a zero or a $1 change. I don't recall anything that was more than just a few dollars per student overall for the district. But there are some modest changes there. Madam Chair and members, moving to Section 8 of the bill, this is the shared time formula, and this is changing the formula from the product of the formula allowance times the weighted count of students to the sum of the formula allowance times the unweighted count of students plus the secondary allowance times the shared time students in grades 7 through 12. So this is basically providing an adjustment to keep the shared time funding revenue neutral after you've converted from the weighted count of students to the unweighted count of students, and it does make an adjustment for the secondary students, which is parallel to what we do in the general education program for the public school students.
Representative Clinzy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed, and this goes back to that same page 9, but in the section previous, on line 9, you used adjusted average daily membership for defining the English proficiency, limited English proficiency students and those programs. Is that the same definition that's going to be used according to the changes made in this new section we're discussing?
Madam Chair and Representative Clinzing, yes, we're using adjusted average daily membership here, and the adjusted average daily membership means that basically the number of students that are being served on an average daily basis. When we get to the shared time calculation, we do the calculation in a similar manner, but it's more on an hourly basis as opposed to a daily basis, because typically the students might be coming in for 1 hour or 2 hours a day, and we calculate the full-time equivalent. So if it's a four-period day and the students are there for 1 hour taking a particular course, they're counted as one-fourth of a pupil unit for that, if that was being done for the whole year.
Madam Chair, quick follow-up.
Representative Clinton.
Thank you. I know that overall there's an attempt being made to try to define a student as a student and not have four or five different definitions.
Mm-hmm.
So is this limited English proficiency definition of a student using average daily membership pretty consistent, or is this going to be an anomaly from that student as a student definition?
Madam Chair and Representative Clinzing, I think it's pretty consistent. We're trying to move to an unweighted average daily membership for all the different funding formulas that we have, including this one. This is a special count because it only includes the LEP students, but it's consistent with the count we're using for the general education formula as well. Article 1, Section 9 on page 10 of the bill is changing the pupil unit weightings for the different grade levels beginning in fiscal year 2007. And so on lines 15 through 21, the pre-kindergarten pupils with a disability are going to be counted as one pupil in average daily membership. Currently, they're weighted at 1.25. On the next section down, pre-kindergarten students who are assessed but determined not to be handicapped are counted as the ratio of the number of hours of assessment to 825. On line 35, the kindergarten students would be counted as half of a pupil unit instead of 0.557 of a pupil unit under current law. On the next page of the bill, line 1, page 11, line 1, is changing the weighting factor for students in grades 1 through 3 from 1.115 pupil units to 1 pupil unit. Line 4 is changing the weighting factor for students in grades 4 through 6 from 1.06 pupil units to 1 pupil unit. The consistent trend here is to move these kids to one student and count a kid as one student. The same is true on line 8 of the bill, page 11. The high school students, instead of being counted as 1.3 pupil units, would be counted as one pupil unit. All of those changes take effect beginning in fiscal year 2007.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Mr. Melcher, any discussion about moving all day, every day kindergarten students to one from that 0.05?
Madam Chair,
Dr. Melcher.
Representative Erickson, there has been discussion about changing all day every day K to one, and there was discussion with the governor before the budget was released, but when it came down to it, that was not included as one of the recommendations. But if the state were to fund all day every day kindergarten, then the recommendation would be to change the weight to one, and then all students would be weighted at one.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Melcher, then, if it ever became mandatory, then? Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, I think if the state were to provide the funding, then whether that was an optional program and just some districts chose to and some didn't choose to, or whether it became a mandatory program, in either case, it would be appropriate to change that pupil weighting to one.
Representative Heidgerken.
Yes, just a comment for Commissioner Siegerman. When I looked at these numbers again, it affected some of the districts in my area quite gravely, in the fact that I have a lot of private elementary students that eventually go on to the secondary level. And again, this does come back to play in their enrollments, but it's something to keep in mind as well. Just a comment.
I think, Representative Heidgerken, you have a parochial school or something that takes a lot of your grade school kids,
right,
and they come back for high school?
Right.
Yeah, those kinds of factors we find really do have an effect on how the numbers come out across the board.
Madam Chair.
Representative,
there are
pardon
anomalies.
Me, Commissioner Siegman.
Oh, that's okay. There are some anomalies like that. We do try to provide transition revenue for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then the secondary, we have a per pupil amount for secondary that replaces the weighting. So we tried to do both of those to make sure that you weren't harmed in the process.
Okay. Madam Chair, section 10 of the bill on page 11 is sunsetting the adjusted marginal cost pupil unit count after fiscal year 2006. The adjusted marginal cost pupil count currently provides additional pupil units for districts with declining enrollment, and the governor's bill replaces that with a separate, more identifiable funding stream for declining enrollment. Section 11 on page 12 of the bill is sunsetting the resident marginal cost pupil unit calculation after fiscal year 2006. Currently, that figure is used to calculate referendum revenue. Again, school districts with declining enrollment are generating additional dollars through that additional pupil weighting. The governor's bill is adjusting the referendum allowance per pupil to factor in the dollar so that there are no winners or losers in fiscal 07 as it relates to the amount of referendum revenue that they qualify for. Section 12 of the bill is the definition of general education revenue. Lines 16 through 21 are eliminating obsolete language dealing with 2003. Line 28 is adding alternative compensation revenue as a new category of general education revenue beginning in fiscal year 06. And then lines 30 through 36 and then on to the next page are including the new secondary education revenue and the new declining enrollment revenue, and they also delete the training and experience as a separate component of revenue because that's rolled into the discretionary revenue, which is also listed as a new component of general education revenue beginning in fiscal year 2007.
Representative Hyde-Gerken.
Yeah, just to go back over T&E now, previous to this, it was an aid. Now it's going to become a revenue that you can levy for. In other words, the state's no longer going to be, if you want T&E, you have to levy for it. Is that my understanding? Is that?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, and Representative Heidgert, that's correct. It's changed from a state aid to part of the discretionary levy, which is an equalized levy. So it's partly aid and partly levy in the governor's recommendation.
Okay, Madam Chair, why the change here? This is the only place where I've noticed an aid go to a revenue. Why the change?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Heidgert, this is a program that is in the process of phasing out. It's currently frozen based on 1997 data, and as part of that phase out, it was viewed as being appropriate since there are a declining number of school districts that are qualifying for that revenue to make it partly aid and partly levy as it phases out.
Representative Heidgert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, this is an important component, I think, in the future out in the school districts that have declining enrollment. I know that we have had a couple, I believe, school districts ask for a levy authority to go back to the days of consolidation. I have districts that have been cutting and cutting because of declining enrollment. So we're right now at one school district that are cutting people, teachers that have 20 years experience. So because of that, there's a lot of getting into the T&E and severance pay, et cetera, that a lot of these school districts are really feeling the pinch on that end of having to cut people with a whole lot of experience, give them severance, et cetera, et cetera. When you take the T&E away, you really are affecting the school districts that have declining enrollment. I would think that if you're trying to help school districts decline enrollment, you'd keep that factor in. At least that option.
Madam Chair.
Dr. Melton.
Representative Heidgert. I would say that this bill does not reduce the amount of revenue available to school districts in T&E by 1 cent. It's the same amount of revenue they currently receive. It is being phased out. We do have fewer and fewer districts qualifying for the revenue each year. You are correct in saying that there is a shift here from levy to an aid to levy. However, those dollars are used to help with the equalization of the discretionary levy, and many of the districts that are losing state aid in T&E are turning around and generating the same or more aid through the equalization of the discretionary levy, which those levies were previously not equalized at all. So those districts that are that would have the largest kind of levy increase as a result of this change to T&E are also beneficiaries of the combining of that in with discretionary, equalizing those levies like the safe schools levy that are currently not equalized. So I think it's important to look at the overall bottom line impact, and I think you'll find that the net change is relatively modest in terms of the tax impact of doing that.
Yeah. One follow-up. So we're on the same page now. When you refer to equity, you're not referring at all to referenda.
Madam Chair, we do have other sections in the bill here.
But this part, the T&E will not, if I'm going to levy for this
to make up for it. For example, I have a school district that has no referendum in play. It's not going to affect them at all. They can still levy. They're still going to get the equalization, et cetera, et cetera. This that you just referred to has got nothing to do with referendums.
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidgert, that's correct. Okay. The school district is guaranteed that they'll get at least a $76 per pupil increase over and above what they're currently getting both for the discretionary levies and the T&E before there's any sort of reverse referendum. Moving to Section 13 of the bill, page 13, this is the general education formula allowance. The governor is recommending an increase to $4,693. That's on page 13, line 12. That's a 2% increase, or $92 per pupil over the current general education formula. In the second year of the biennium, the governor is recommending a formula of $5,188 per unweighted student. That's also a 2% increase over the level of the formula in the first year of the biennium, but there's the adjustment that's being made here because of the elimination of the pupil weights and also because of the elimination of the separate reduction for teachers' retirement and so forth. Those are handled in other sections of the bill. Madam Chair and members, on page 13.
Sorry, Representative.
Yeah, Clinton. I'm sorry. I've got a question again.
Representative Heidgert, and I didn't realize you were a follow-up.
Okay. I'm looking at line 10, the formula allowance for fiscal year 202. It has a formula allowance for fiscal year 203, and subsequent years is 4,601. So 2004 was 4,601, is what you're saying. 05 is 4,693. Nope, it was 04 and 05 were the same at 4601. Okay, those years. Okay, good enough. Then I'm on the same page. All right, thank you.
Representative Clinton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meltzer, you just mentioned a 2% increase, and you said we weren't talking about referendums yet. So does that 2% increase include locally passed referendum dollars?
Dr. Meltzer. Representative Clinton, no, that is entirely funded with state aid.
Thank you.
Moving to Section 14 of the bill on extended time revenue, on page 13, line 20, the governor is recommending an increase from 4601 to 4693. This particular formula is already delinked from the general education formula, and this section is increasing the formula for extended time to the same 2% as the general education formula is increased in the first year of the biennium. The new language on lines 24 through 28 is setting the formula for the extended time revenue at $5,801 per unweighted student beginning in fiscal year 2007, and that's equivalent to a 2% increase. Again, the number is going up by a larger amount than the regular formula because most of the students involved in the extended time program are secondary students, because they will no longer be weighted. In order for the dollar increase to be equivalent, the formula per student has increased by a larger amount. But it is a 2% increase, and the total amount of dollars for extended time programs in the second year of the biennium. Section 15 of the bill is the new language, and that's on the bottom of page 13, the top of page 14, the new language for the secondary education revenue. And this provides that in addition to the basic formula allowance, so every student is generating $5,188, secondary students in grades 7 through 12 would generate an additional $936. And this is to reflect the higher cost of secondary education. This is about an 18% differential between the elementary formula and the secondary formula. The current formula provides approximately a 19% differential between elementary and the secondary students. Section 16 of the bill on page 14 is the new formula for declining enrollment. So instead of school districts with declining enrollment counting additional pupil units and having that get into the pupil unit formula, the governor's recommending having a separate formula that's more identifiable as to the amount of funding the state is providing for declining enrollment. And this would provide $1,297 times the decline in the adjusted pupil units between the previous year and the current school year. And the $1,297 is 25% of the formula. So we're replacing the current formula that provides 23% more pupil unit, basically, based on the decline, with a formula that provides an equivalent dollar amount, 25% of the formula, in a separate category. And it just makes the breakdown of general education funding a little bit more transparent, that you can look and see how much is the district receiving for every kid. That's the $5,188. How much are they receiving because of the secondary students costing more? That's the secondary allowance of the extra $936 per student. And then how much are they receiving because of declining enrollment? And that's the $1,297 times the decline in the enrollment since the prior school year. It's generally very close to the amount of dollars that are currently being allocated for declining enrollment, but through a separate, more transparent formula. Section 17 of the bill is the compensatory education formula. And on page 14, line 21, the governor is recommending delinking the compensatory formula from the general education formula and inflating it by 2%. So instead of it being based on the formula allowance minus 415, the calculation would be based on $4,278, which is, in fact, the formula allowance of $4,693 minus $415. So it's the same amount of money as if the formula had not been delinked. It is inflated by 2%, but it is delinked so that in future years there would be a requirement for the legislature to enact legislation to create additional increases. The remainder of that section, the new language, is setting the compensatory formula at $4,388 in the second year of the biennium. That provides an additional 2% increase in compensatory revenue in the second year of the biennium. Again, it's delinked. It requires a change in the bill to provide that inflation in the second year.
Representative Gaffney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Melcher, I'm trying to understand the relationship between, and I'm you'll be patient with me for a moment, page 13. Well, before, don't anybody turn any pages yet. the sound would be deafening. The change in basic formula to reflect the eraser of the weighting, mm-hmm, versus the compensatory numbers, because it seems like there will appear to be a sharp increase in the formula allowance, but no equivalent increase in the compensatory allowance. And can you speak to that, please?
Madam Chair.
No, sure.
And Representative Dabney, the compensatory calculation is already based on unweighted student counts. We don't weight the compensatory students for purposes of doing the compensatory calculation. We do adjust for concentration. And so there would not be any need to adjust for the change in the weighting factor in the compensatory formula itself. So this is simply providing a straight-up 2% increase in the first year, a 2% increase in the second year, and delinking, where in the case of the general education formula, because of the elimination of the pupil weights and because of the elimination of the subtraction for the pension adjustment, that one required a different kind of adjustment in order to make the dollars come out at the same as current law plus the 2% increase.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Melcher.
Oh, Representative Grading.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This one, and we can talk about it more when I know we're just walking through the bill right now, but this one concerns me when we delink the compensatory. And I know that when Commissioner Segrin was Representative Segrin, you were always a big supporter of compensatory revenue, and I know that no harm is done yet because it's 2% increase like the formula. But when we look at the extended time revenue, even though it's adjusted for the change in weighting, we got the 2% increase only in the second year. And this is the sort of thing that I worry about with compensatories. That's not accurate.
Madam Chair and Representative Grayling, turn to page 13 of the bill, line 20. Mm-hmm. you can see that the extended time formula has increased from 4601 to 4693 for the first year of the biennium, so there is a 2% increase there. And then the increase to 5801 includes the 2% increase for the second year plus an adjustment for the elimination of the secondary grade level weighting.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Grannan.
Thank you for that clarification, and I stand corrected. So we're just, it's the change in the formula that we changed it for the second year and the first year, and that's why it's broken out. In any case, if it were what we did in this situation, it would be the sort of thing we could do, though, with the compensatory in the future, and we have to have that discussion then every single year. And I think something that is as constant as compensatory, you know, it's kind of a useless, I don't know if it's useless unless some would like to cut it, but for those of us who think that it's a constant that should be supported, then it's a useless thing to have that argument every single time and have to justify once again that that kids on free and reduced lunch costs more money. And I know that we've at times discussed the weightings and or the concentration factor and that sort of thing, but to actually de-link this from the formula, I would urge you to check again with the governor and see if we couldn't at some point down the road here link that back up again.
All right, Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, going to Section 18 of the bill on page 15, the new language is adjusting the calculation of the training and experience allowance for the elimination of the pupil unit weightings. You'll see on line 19 that the multiplier used in calculating the training and experience allowance is set at $800 instead of $660, and that's to provide an equivalent number of dollars for training and experience compared to the current formula. Section 19 of the bill is the definitions for sparsity, and on page 16, line 35 and 36, the governor is recommending delinking the sparsity allowance from the general education allowance, and the sparsity allowance would be set at $4,693 per pupil in the first year of the biennium. That's a 2% increase over current law, and $4,787 per pupil in the second year. That's an additional 2% increase. Again, because the sparsity formula is currently not based on a weighted count, it's based on just the number of students in secondary schools, there's no further adjustment for elimination of the pupil weightings. It's just a straight up 2% and 2%. The next section, section 20 on page 17, line 7.
Excuse me, Dr. Melcher. Representative Grating, I missed your hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I know I looked around.
I was. You did, and I was actually looking for some person from Greater Minnesota to speak up on this one, but since they didn't, I would say that, you know, to me the same argument applies here. We're not going to ever not have sparsity, and assuming we keep our Minnesota value of kids not having to be on the bus forever, then, you know, I don't see the point of having the people in sparsely populated areas have to make this argument every single time either. To me, it's a constant, just like kids on free and reduced lunch are a constant, and it should be linked to the formula and not have to be rediscussed every time.
Representative Clinging.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that when we de-link these, we also have the opportunity to discuss putting more money into some of these categoricals as opposed to always tying them to whatever increase we make for the general formula, because oftentimes the general formula is a huge, much huger amount of money to deal with, and if we have an extra few million sitting around, it would be easier to put it to a delinked categorical than it would to try to figure out how to tie it to the linked, I guess, sparsity or concentration. It seems to me like a benefit to the discussion process in terms of being able to really focus on some of these areas and maybe put some more money into them. Was that the rationale, or could it be?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I think the rationale was to try to make our formula system more understandable and transparent for people. And then the governor's intent was to send a clear message that these are all important, they all deserve a formula increase. And in addition, we have discussed, you know, this. We are beginning the discussion, and we should. It was interesting when Dr. Melcher was talking about the secondary amount of money. And when the department analyzes the actual cost that's being charged to secondary versus elementary, you find some interesting things happening there, but you don't get that examination when it's, you know, kind of in this other weighted kind of a system. So we're not really doing any kind of cost analysis. So I think it does, you know, provide some opportunities for legislators to look at different formulas within there and say, should we do it differently? Is this an old formula? Should we look at maybe a different square mile, you know, amount for sparsity, or should we base it on, you know, in a little bit different way? So I think it does. And in the 12 years I've been here, we didn't discuss this. We never got into the internal formulas to really look at cost factors, et cetera. And I think this was really the governor's rationale, was to, first of all, just make it more understandable for people so you can go back to your folks and say, we're getting $51.88 for our formula, we're getting X amount per dollars for sparsity, we're getting X amount for decline, and then you can, you know, talk about the you know, the other things in the future.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the risk of being redundant, I agree with Representative Plinzing and also with the Commissioner. It occurred to me in thinking about this, you know, being mindful of Representative Greiling, your thoughts, that some of these things do need to go up. But in thinking about it, I think there are probably some things that can be tied to other things such as cost. When I think about transportation, you know, having a transportation-related expense go up based on what the formula does has no bearing on what the cost of transportation is. So I like the idea of separating that, so we have an opportunity to look at those kinds of changes, as Representative Plinzing said, to base them on some sort of cost factors. Now, there might be some other things that maybe aren't related at all to either cost or to the formula, in which case we just look at those individually. And as the Commissioner stated, it gives us a chance to really individually to come up with an argument for or against funding at all, funding the same, funding more. Quite frankly, it probably makes more work for us here because we look at each thing independently as opposed to letting everything just be connected to the big tractor at the front, which is the formula. But I kind of like the idea of being able to look at these things independently, and quite frankly, sometimes we probably need increases that are greater than what the increase would be with the formula. In some cases, not needed. So, you know, I think each of these have to be looked at differently to determine. I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all, and that's why I think the delinquents is probably a good idea.
We have just a plethora of ideas here, so Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Representative Greiling, I think there will be times when we won't need transportation sparsity in some districts, because I believe some districts will be futuristic thinkers, such as the cyberspace school here in St. Paul, where there are only going to be certain days that they can be transported to a building. The rest of the time, they're going to have to stay at home, because these bus trips will be... they'll be incredible when you think of the number of miles and hours kids will have to sit. So I look forward to districts maybe north of Representative Eakin thinking outside the box, and transportation sparsity wouldn't be an issue. So we do want to discuss it every 2 years.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of, in response to, I guess, what Representative Demmer and Representative Plinzing were referring to, I think the greater likelihood of delinking the categorical aids is not to see an increase in funding over time. It's to see a decrease, because what you're doing in effect is you're marginalizing these programs, or marginalizing the categorical aids, and making it more difficult to secure the support necessary to adequately fund them. So I think that we need to really take another look at that. The fact is that if you link it to the base formula, you at least provide a base, and you can still, it seems to me, tell me if I'm not correct, but you can still cost out and talk about what the separate costs are of the sparsity aid and the other categoricals, compensatory, and you can still make adjustments, but at least you've got a base increase that you can count on. And for the schools that are receiving the categorical aids, the compensatory and sparsity, their costs have been increasing. And I can certainly speak for our area, the sparsity is not going, the costs for sparsity and the funding needs for sparsity are not going down, they continue to increase. So I think that we got to be careful not to marginalize these categorical aids and put them in a position where they're struggling to get the funding they need every single year.
Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, and I rather than be redundant, but I had brought this up before, my concerns with delinking. Right now, when you look at, we're looking at delinking compensatory and sparsity aid. And when you look at the school districts that are getting that, those are, it tends to be some of the inner cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts as well as those out in the rural areas. So you're affecting school districts that really have needs in those particular areas in comparison to some of the other school districts. When I look at the problem with delink, a couple years down in 08, we have to go back to the board or back here and try to get a funding increase or a percentage increase. And any time you do that, you look at which districts are being affected, which ones are not. And when you look at delinking, especially compensatory sparsity, I think we're affecting some of the real poor school districts that have and have nots we're dealing with. So you can look at Representative Bemmer, for example, as much as you want to be more efficient in transportation. I have in Minnewaska, the first kids getting on at 6 or 5 a.m. We can be more efficient. We probably can put those kids on at 5 a.m. in the morning, a kindergarten kid or first grade kid, and have them get home at 8 o'clock at night. We can become that efficient, but do we want to go there? And those are things that you have to think about when you start doing these things.
To that point, Representative Gemmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Heidgerken, in my school district, we don't allow any kids to be on a bus over 1 hour. We've made that choice, and our education costs are not among the lowest in the state, but we think that's important, so your thought is not lost on me. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Did you want to say something else?
Just
briefly, Representative?
Yes, briefly.
All right.
To that point, I think if you look at some of the rural districts that I have covering an entire county and into a couple counties, and some of those students are probably on a bus 30 miles. And I don't know if you have that sparse of a district, but I do. And I think Representative Eakin does as well. But I know some of those areas, it's a little bit different of a ball game that you're playing with. But just to that point, thank you.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to get in this discussion for just a moment.
But folks, after the next two speakers, Bernardi and Representative Greiling again, we're going to stop stating opinions and go back to the points that we were going through in the bill. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the spirit of Representative Carlson, I'm going to go back to my first term when I was in the legislature and to 30 years ago, it's kind of funny that I'm saying this now, but we had a surplus and transportation, fuel prices were just skyrocketing and it was impacting our schools, and we had a bill that was a $30 million emergency aid to schools to help pay for the rising cost of fuel costs for transportation, and I believe heating too, I'm not certain on that. But we had a surplus, and it didn't pass. So I'm very cautious about the spirit of intent behind this or what actually will happen, because even times of surplus and emergency costs, we still couldn't get support to make this happen.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Heidgerken, I don't call it redundant. I call it the squeaky wheels get the oil around here. But anyway, I just wanted to say also that I think in terms of all of us can understand, is it easier to pass a bill or to repeal legislation? And I think when you think of it that way, you know, the dynamic is on the side of keeping sparsity and keeping compensatory strong by having them in the bill. It doesn't mean, it's not a trade-off with thinking creatively, because we can always change anything or pull anything out and discuss it differently ourselves. But as soon as you have to fight for something every single time, then that's what you got. It's not a given anymore, and then you're impaired in getting anything else. You might have a great victory and all you got was what you had the year before.
I believe Commissioner, Dr. Melcher, you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Page 17 of the bill, sections 20 and 21, are changing the cross-references to the elementary and secondary sparsity formulas to use this D-linked sparsity allowance rather than the general education formula allowance. So they're really a kind of a technical cross-reference to go with the change that we've just discussed. Section 22 of the bill is the operating capital formula, And the governor is recommending here adjusting the allowances for operating capital to reflect the elimination of the pupil unit weighting changes. So on line 8 of page 18, you'll see that the $73 per pupil equipment portion of the operating capital formula is changed to $88 per pupil. There's no inflationary increase being provided here. This is simply an adjustment for the elimination of the pupil weighting changes. And then down on page 18, line 16, you'll see that the $100 figure for the facilities portion is increased to $120. And then also down a little further on line 25, the $30 portion is increased to $43. So it's the same formula structure we have currently. It's just simply updating for the elimination of the pupil unit weighting changes to provide the same amount of operating capital revenue as under current law. And then the stricken language that you see on lines 27 through 34 is obsolete language that applied only to fiscal years 2001, 2002, and 2003. Section 23 of the bill on page 19 is a change in the equalizing factor for the operating capital levy. You'll see that we've stricken the words marginal cost from the calculation because we're no longer using marginal cost pupil units. We're using the unweighted pupils to do the equalization. And as a result of the change in the number of pupil units, we've increased the equalizing factor from 22,222 to 26,640 simply to keep the same the state aid and levy mix the same as it is under current law with the change in the pupil unit weights. Next, we go down to the transportation sparsity formula on section 24, page 19. And again, the governor's recommending delinking and inflating the transportation sparsity calculations. You can see on line 20 that the formula is set at $46.93 in fiscal 06 and $51.88 in fiscal 07. Those are the same as the general education formula amounts. It provides the same 2% increase each year, but it is delinked. The next section, section 25 of the bill, is on line 28 of page 19, is cross-referencing the transportation allowance rather than the formula allowance. And then on the next page, you'll see that beginning in fiscal year 2007, that some of the coefficients used in calculating the transportation sparsity have been adjusted based on newer data. The existing transportation sparsity formula was based on computer runs that were done in 1995 when transportation sparsity was rolled into the general education formula. These are updated based on 2003 data, and what we've seen is some change in the slope of the relationship between sparsity and transportation. On page 20, line 7, you'll see that there was a factor there of 26 one-hundredths. That's now changed to 28 one-hundredths. It reflects a little bit steeper line as you go from districts that have not so much sparsity to districts that are more sparsely populated. But then you also see that the coefficient on page 20, line 5, is a little bit lower than it used to be, and also the coefficient on page 20, line 10. So the bottom line here is that a couple of years ago, when the $415 was rolled into the general education formula, that we provided about a 10% bump on transportation sparsity funding as a kind of a byproduct of the 415 transfer into the formula. When we look at the actual cost for transportation, they didn't grow that quickly on a statewide basis in the early 2002-2003 year at the time that 10% increase was being provided. When you run the new numbers based on current transportation costs, what you find is on the average, we're just slightly overfunding transportation sparsity, but it varies among districts. So if you get to a really low population density rural district, there's a little bit of an increase in terms of a level of funding. If you're at a district that has less transportation sparsity, there's a little bit of a decrease. Overall, I think it's about a $2 million reduction in the total amount of dollars going into transportation sparsity, and it basically reflects the fact that transportation costs weren't growing as rapidly in the early 2000s as the would have been implied by that 10% bump that went in 2003 because of the roll-in. Section 26 is the equity formula, and the language on page 20, line 23, is eliminating an obsolete reference to supplemental and transition revenue. And beginning on page 20, line 30, the governor is recommending that the current equity formula, which currently has separate formulas for the metropolitan area and the rural districts, be combined into one formula for all school districts, so it would be a uniform formula statewide. And under this new formula, any school district in the state that has referendum revenue per pupil that's less than 28% of the formula allowance would qualify for equity revenue. The calculation of equity revenue under the new formula is described on page 21, where the funding would be based on the sliding scale that provides up to $101 times the equity index for a school district. So under this formula, a school district that has no referendum revenue at all would qualify for $101 of equity revenue per pupil. That would be a gradual sliding scale, so that if a district had a referendum that was equal to 28% of the general education formula, which is about $1,400 per student, they would qualify for no equity revenue. So all of the dollars in the equity formula would be on a sliding scale rather than the current formula, which has one formula for the metro, another formula for rural, and then it takes some of the money and gives everybody a $13 per pupil amount, and then takes the remaining money and puts that on a sliding scale. The next several sections are going into some of those.
And I'm sorry, just a second, I missed your hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I raise it a little higher. I can't see you.
To that point, a little history, please, Mr. Melcher. Why were there two different rates? Why was there one for the metro, and why was there one for the rural?
Well, Madam Chair, the House originally had proposed something similar to what we're looking at. And because we wanted to make sure that we didn't have a growing disparity between the low revenue districts and the higher revenue districts. And so we did propose just a pretty simple basic formula like this that would allow districts that, you know, couldn't pass referendums over and over and over to have some aid levy mix that would help them make sure that there was not a big gap. We took that to past our, you know, our house, and we went to conference committee with it, and in the process of conference committee we came out with two equity formulas, a metro and a rural. And I could go into a lot of detail with you, but I don't think I want to. Basically, we just feel like it's unnecessary to have that kind of two separate things. We should look at just a scaled version between the 5th and the 95th percentile. We got into a kind of a convoluted, you know, if you could pass $1 of referendum, then you got equity, and it just got into, I think, really not a very good policy type of proposal. So we're just proposing to look at districts' total revenue, what they get based on, you know, where you are in the, between the 5th and the 95th percentile, and then giving you some aid because of that. So many of your districts that if you don't have referendum or you have a low referendum, you will be getting some additional aid and levy that's equalized. And it will be very helpful. Some of your districts will be getting up to $101, which is another 2% additional revenue.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garland.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Lest it be said, I never give out a compliment about this bill. I do like this part, and not because it benefits one area over another, but because it is fair, it's based on need. And so I don't think it's fair for kids where their parents or their people in their community won't pass any levy at all, then they don't get any of this money, and they might be a poor area. So this is based on not what the adults do responsibly or not, but instead what is needed based on what money is available.
A compliment.
Madam Chair. Commissioner. Thank you. I wholeheartedly appreciate that compliment, Representative Growling.
Hang on.
Madam Chair, moving to the next section of the bill.
Dr. Melcher.
There are several other changes that are needed to bring about this change in the equity formula. The first one is Section 27, which is limiting the separate regional calculation to 2006. And then Section 28 of the bill is defining under this new formula the equity gap as being the difference between the district's referendum per pupil and the 28% of the formula. And then Section 29 is calculating the equity index for the district under this new formula. Section 30 is, again, limiting the application of the separate regions for equity purposes to fiscal year 2006. And then Section 31 on page 22 of the bill is adjusting the equalizing factor for the equity levy to $572,000 to reflect the change in the weighting factor to keep the aid and levy mix where it's at currently, using the unweighted pupils in the calculation rather than the weighted pupils. Now, Section 32 on page 23 of the bill moves into another issue, and that is the calculation of the transition revenue. The language on page 23, beginning on line 13, first of all specifies that this new calculation of transition revenue will apply for 4 years from fiscal year 2007 through fiscal year 2010. And this calculation will guarantee a district that it will receive a $199 increase per unweighted student over the amount that it would have received from the levies that are being repealed as part of the governor's proposal. And it goes through those particular levies on page 23, lines 24 through 36. So we're starting off with the language with $199 being on line 20. So the district is guaranteed to receive the $199 plus the amount of the district's levy limitation in taxes payable 2005 for, on line 24, building leases, excluding the portion of building leases attributable to levies that were basically, there's a cross-reference to another section here, but this relates to the capital levies that the district had already committed to. Line 29 is the unemployment insurance levy. Line 31, the judgment levy. Line 33, the safe schools. Line 35, the tax-based replacement levy. The following page, we go through the other levies being repealed. Ice arenas, swimming pools, lost interest earnings, severance, extended hours and school days levy that applies to the Valley Crossing School, and then other miscellaneous levies according to laws 1996 and laws 2001, which are two specific school districts.
Dr. Melcher, how often do we have a judgment levy in a school district? And what do they usually come to, or is there a usual? Is it very rare?
Madam Chair, I believe we've had over the last few years in the neighborhood of 3 to 5 school districts levying for judgments each year. The last couple of years, the state total has been about $85,000, and it's been a little bit higher than that in some preceding years, but there is a certain amount of uncertainty there. It's, after all, based on somebody suing a district and winning in court.
So I guess my thought was we're folding this in with others, and I know it's very unusual that they have to levy for it, but when something happens and they do have to levy for it, doesn't it end up being a fairly large amount?
Madam Chair, as I said, the last few years it's been, you know, 3 or 4 districts levying for a total of about $85,000, so it can be very small, but we have heard some of the testimony earlier about the current situation with West Tonka, with the, you know, potential of a $2 million amount, and so, you know, we do have concerns that we could be leaving districts open to some problems if that kind of safety valve isn't in the system.
Yeah, thank you.
Madam Chair and members, the kind of track of where I'm at. I'm still here.
Well, members, we've made it all the way to page 24 now, and it's only 2 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
How about
Chair? Madam Chair, this is probably the meatiest part of the bill anyway. So.
Yes, you're probably right.
Oh, Madam Chair, the section, the language at the bottom of page 24 is dealing with the transition revenue for the pre-kindergarten programs, the High Five program and the community kindergarten program in Minneapolis and St. Paul, but also there were at least a dozen other districts across the state that had a similar program. And what this is doing is guaranteeing those districts that as part of their transition revenue, they will receive funding equivalent to the amount that they were receiving back in fiscal year 04 as a result of them counting those students as kindergartners in the formula in fiscal year 2004.
Representative Heidger.
Yes, to that point, hadn't we just done that? Didn't we just do that last year? Now we're going to do it again? I thought we went through this.
Representative Heidger, and the bill, you know, didn't really. This thing never got discussed last year.
But it's still under my understanding that they're getting it now.
Madam Chair.
Dr. Melcher.
Representative Heidgerton, this was in both House and Senate bills last year, but because there was no budget agreement, it did not pass. They were received this money in fiscal 2004. Because the bill didn't pass last year, they're not receiving the money currently in fiscal 05.
Okay.
And this bill would reinstate the money beginning in fiscal year 2006 as part of the transition revenue.
Okay. Now, if, Madam Chair, if we implement this again and it's going to cause some school districts to double dip because there's already a program in play that other school districts are getting funding of this kind, this would give them added revenues just for certain school districts, right?
Madam Chair, what this would do would be to take those districts that had been reporting students that were basically four-year-old pre-kindergartners as kindergartners for 2004 and earlier, and had been receiving general education revenue for them as kindergartners, it would allow them to continue to receive that general education revenue for them in the 2007, 8, 9, 10 school years. They would have to levy for it. It would be a transition levy. They're not getting paid twice for these kids, but they're getting paid for kids that aren't generally funded because they're four-year-old pre-kindergartners rather than five-year-old kindergarten students.
Madam Chair, in reality, you're opening up an avenue for certain school districts to do something where some other school districts cannot.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Siegman.
Madam Chair, the history of this, Representative Heidgerken, is that a number of school districts documentation, direction from past department administrators had given an okay that they could do this. And so it was felt out of fairness because past administrations, other department personnel had said under their interpretation they thought this was okay. Districts did go ahead and do this. So they were doing it thinking that it was, quote, legal. When Dr. Melcher started looking into this a couple of years ago, he discovered that it was indeed not legal to do this. But after looking at past correspondence, it was not clear that it was the district's fault totally or the department's fault totally on this thing. So we thought out of fairness, we should allow them to continue and transition with this for a few years, and then they have to transition with the idea of saying if they want to continue doing a pre-K program, then they'll have to, you know, levy eventually, ask the voters to approve it eventually. But there's a transition period of time to allow them to prepare for that. And that's the history of it. So it's just, for me, it's a fairness thing to say if there had been wrong direction, it's not their fault. But we also want to make sure that going forward that we're fair to the other districts that haven't been doing it. So we are addressing your concern.
Madam Chair, okay, to that point now, so there's still going to be some state aid going until the levies come into place, right?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Heidgren, this is converted, for, first of all, for fiscal 05, no state aid. Those districts that have continued the programs, but they're using, basically spending down fund balances and using other resources to pay for them. In fiscal 06, they will be allowed to levy for those programs. It is an equalized levy. I know in the case of Minneapolis-St. Paul, they have a relatively strong tax base, so the majority of the money is coming from the levy and not from the aid.
But there still are state monies coming with the equalized aid.
There are some state aids going to the districts, yes.
Proceed, please.
Madam Chair and members, Section 33 of the bill on page 25 is the transition levy, and this is simply updating the equalizing factor on page 25, line 9, to reflect the elimination of the pupil weight, so we simply increase the equalizing factor to keep the aid levy mix the same.
Members, if you're leaving, would you please keep your data with your files so that we will be using it again tomorrow and the next day? I had thought we'd be at page 52 when we finished today. Eternal optimist.
Madam Chair, members, Section 34 on page 25 is the aid formula for the alternative compensation program. It divides the aid into the basic alternative compensation aid, which would be $225 per pupil in fiscal 06 and $155 per pupil in fiscal 07. And then there's a separate section that provides the equalization aid on the levy. So page 25, lines 14 through 19 are defining the aid as equal to the revenue for 06. That's $225 per pupil. Page 25, line 22 is defining the basic aid for fiscal 07 as 68.9% of the revenue. That comes to $155 per pupil. The bottom of page 25, there's a limit placed on the amount of the alternative compensation basic aid for fiscal 06 at $16,727,000 and for fiscal 07 at $61,871,000. That includes the $3.7 million in the current alternative compensation program plus the $10 million that the governor's recommending as new money for fiscal 06 plus the $50 million that the governor's recommending as new money for fiscal 07. And then because of the payment schedule being 81% during the current year and 19% in the final payment, the actual aid numbers that work out to tie out to those numbers are the $16 million and the $61 million of state aid entitlement for school districts. Section 35 on page 26 is the alternative compensation levy, and this is an equalized levy. The equalizing factor is $6,900. Per pupil, that's approximately the state median level of adjusted net tax capacity per pupil. It's in between Rochester and Burnsville if you're trying to get a kind of a handle on how high that level of equalization is on a per pupil basis. Section 36 of the bill is the alternative compensation aid, and that defines the alternative compensation aid as being the sum of the equalization aid for the levy plus the basic $155 per pupil aid for the school district. Section 37 is the discretionary levy on page 26 of the bill toward the bottom. It's defining the discretionary revenue as the sum of $150 plus the district's training and experience allowance. This is where the training and experience piece comes back into the discretionary. Section 38 on page 27.
Excuse me, sir. Representative Greiland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Melcher, is this a revenue neutral once we've combined all these things? I realize there's the reverse referendum on here, but if assuming everybody passed it, would it be the sum total of all the other levies or are or not?
Madam Chair and Representative Greiland, the discretionary revenue is on average a $76 per pupil increase for the school district. So we're replacing $74 of miscellaneous levies along with $150 of a new equalized levy. So the average district is getting a $76 per pupil increase from this.
Representative Browning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. And how does that compare? So this is all local levy and equalized. How does it compare with, is it revenue neutral for the state? And in other words, are we still paying about the same amount that we did before? It's not revenue neutral for the districts. It's a winner, but I'm trying to figure out how much is property taxes and how much is state. Is it revenue neutral for the state as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, this is replacing these levies that were previously unequalized with a new equalized property tax levy. So there is a net increase in the state aid. And let me see if I can find the number here. On a statewide basis, if you factor in the new equalization aid, which is about $14 million, and you net off the training and experience aid that's been converted to levy, you net all that out, you end up with about a $9.6 million increase in the state aid and about a $49 million increase in the property tax compared to current law. So a portion of the new $76 per student is coming from state aid and a portion is coming from property tax. Page 27 of the bill is defining the levy, and that's equalized at $6,900 per pupil. Section 39 is the discretionary aid. That's the difference between the revenue and the equalized levy. Section 40 on page 27 is the definition of general education aid, and it's deleting obsolete language on page 27. On page 28, it's redefining the general education aid for fiscal 07 and later, and you can see that there's a new line added on line 15 for the alternative compensation aid. There's a new line added on line 19 for the discretionary aid. And I believe those are the two new categories that are added here. Because the new defining enrollment funding and the new secondary education funding are all aid. There's no separate aid levy mix on those. Those are included in the general education revenue amount that's back up on line 8. So this is just redefining the total of the general education aid to reflect the new components that we've already discussed. And then on page 28, section 41, we get into the referendum revenue. On page 29, the language deleted on lines 4 through 9 is obsolete language. The language on lines 22 through 33 is directing the department to recalculate the referendum revenue allowance for each district in order to neutralize the effect of the pupil unit weighting changes. And that's done on a district-by-district basis. So if a district had 5% fewer pupil units, then their allowance per pupil goes up 5%, and they get the same amount of money on their referendum. And that's done on an individual district basis, so there aren't any winners or losers in fiscal 07 from that process. Section 42 is the referendum allowance limit. The deleted language is obsolete language from 2003. The key language here is down on line, page 30, line 25, which is increasing the referendum cap from 18.6% of the formula to 28% of the formula. And also there's a dollar amount that goes with that from $855.79 up to $1,396. Other kind of critical language here is part of the governor's recommendation at the top of page 31. The stricken language is deleting a provision that would sunset the inflationary increase for those districts that have a referendum allowance calculated based on their 1994 referendum level. So under current law, all school districts receive an inflationary increase on their referendum cap through 2008. After 2008, those districts that were received the referendum allowance that was grandfathered based on their 1994 referendum would no longer receive that inflation based on the CPI. By striking this language, they would continue to receive the inflation at the same rate as other districts based on the CPI. Section 43 of the bill is calculating the referendum revenue equal to the referendum allowance multiplied by the resident pupil units. Again, we've deleted the use of the term marginal cost pupil units here, and the allowances are all based on the basically the unweighted number of students, resident students being served in the current year. Section 44 of the bill is, first of all, on page 31, lines 28 through 33, deleting obsolete language that relates to fiscal year 2003 and 2004. On the next page of the bill, at the top, page 32, the first-tier referendum equalization is increased from $500 to $601 to adjust for the unweighting of the students. The $500 per weighted pupil is equivalent to $601 per unweighted pupil. Also changing the second-tier equalization to go up to 28% of the formula, and that's on page 32, line 19. So there's an expansion of the equalization up to the level of the new cap so that districts with lower property value per pupil unit are more able to participate in the in that referendum. Section 45 of the bill on page 33 is adjusting the equalizing factors for referendum equalization to reflect the pupil employees.
Excuse me, Dr. Melcher. Representative Heidgert.
Thank you. Yeah, and
where was your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 32, just to make sure that I'm on the same page with you. When you're referring to first tier, second tier, first tier now equalization, okay, if it's a school district is fairly well-to-do, okay, it would be easy to pass. What's the difference? Just basically tell me what's the difference between first tier and second tier?
Madam Chair,
Dr. Melcher,
Representative Heidgert, the state provides a higher share of the first tier equalization than the second tier equalization. The current level of equalization is that we're guaranteeing a property tax base of $476,000 of market value per student in the first tier, and in the second tier we're guaranteeing a tax base of $270,000 per student. So if you have relatively high property values, well, if you're in a very high property value district, you would probably qualify for equalization in either tier. But if you're a district that's in the middle somewhere, you'll probably qualify for equalization in the first tier, but not the second tier. And if you have relatively low valuation, you'd qualify for equalization both in the first tier and the second tier.
I think we will end at this point, and we'll pick up here on page 32 tomorrow. Members, Representative Dorn, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the minutes.
Thank you. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved, and this meeting is adjourned, and we will begin promptly tomorrow.